It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The U.S. Supreme Court completed its term earlier this week with a flurry of decisions, from affirming birth control exemptions for employers to the need for a warrant to search cell phones. Here to discuss how these decisions and others will impact our lives is Pitt Law Professor David Harris. Howdy, David.
Good to see you, Paul. Good to be back with you.
Perhaps the most controversial of the Supreme Court's recent decisions occurred on Monday in its Hobby Lobby ruling, a 5-4 ruling in favor of a corporation's right to object on religious grounds to the Affordable Care Act's contraception mandate. What does this decision mean, and how was it arrived at?
This decision is very important because it's the first time that we see the Religious Freedom Restoration Act applied to for-profit corporations in this way. The Affordable Care Act said that anybody providing insurance to their employees must provide access to all methods of birth control. And the folks who run Hobby Lobby, which is a family-held corporation, had religious objections, not to all of those types of birth control, but to four of them, and did not want to provide them. And the Supreme Court said they get a religious objection, a religious exemption, excuse me, to that provision of the Affordable Care Act. They cannot be forced by the government to give all of those birth control methods if they have a religious objection. So people who work for employers in what Justice Alito called closely held corporations, those people are out of luck if they want to get all of those birth control methods. They have to find some other way to get them.
And let's explain what the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is and how that comes into play here.
Well, that's a federal statute enacted by the Congress in the 1990s. It depends on who you ask, but it was designed to restore the condition of religious freedom before another Supreme Court decision some years ago. And what the dispute is often about whether or not that would ever have been thought to apply to for-profit corporations. And the Supreme Court said, yes, it does. You don't give up your right to religious freedom just because you're acting in a corporate form. You should have the ability to get the benefits of being a corporation without having to give up your religious freedom.
A gentleman by the name of John Neurer, a spokesman for the liberal advocacy group Keystone Progress, issued a statement in reaction to Monday's ruling. He says the decision, quote, opens the floodgates to religious critiques. Despite the majority's claim that the decision does not apply to religious objections to blood transfusions, we agree with Justice Ginsburg's dissent that says this is a decision of startling breadth, end quote. Is it, David? And how do you interpret this decision? Does this open those that were supporting this decision say,
yes,
well, now we can change all sorts of things on the basis of this?
Well, I think there's a lot to that statement, and I'm not affiliated with that group in any way. And here's why. Justice Alito, who wrote the opinion, was at great pains to say this is a very narrow decision. It does not give anybody license to object on just any grounds to government laws because of their religious practices. But Justice Ginsburg, I think, makes a great point when she says, well, look, if you can object based on religious practices to a contraception mandate, what's to keep you from objecting to government laws and regulations on a whole bunch of other religious-based beliefs, in support of your position that, say, well, I run a business I don't want to allow to trip over my religious beliefs. Here's an example. We had reports just a short time ago this year that there's a business somewhere in the United States, a small mom-and-pop photography business. They do weddings. Can that business refuse to do the wedding of a gay couple where that wedding is legal in that state and they don't want any part of it? Could an employer say, well, I don't want to hire women unless they have the full permission of their husbands because I have beliefs about the subjugation or the second place of women to men in the family? The court did say that you couldn't use religious objections to justify racial discrimination, but that was the only thing that they mentioned. They did not mention gender discrimination. They did not mention sexual orientation discrimination, nothing else. So there is there will be a train of cases heading into courts in which religious objections are the basis for claiming exemptions from any number of government regulations and laws.
And if we're talking about businesses or corporations that provide health insurance plans for their employees, if an organization is steeped in a religious philosophy that says, for example, we don't believe that you need to have medical attention for a particular condition, that what we believe is we can just lay hands and that's how we would prefer that you seek out a cure. I mean, how much – I mean, that's an extreme example, but how much can this decision be taken and interpreted in a way that allows corporations to deviate from all sorts of what people would term health care issues that would be covered by the Affordable Care Act?
Well, it does sound like an extreme example, but really it's not. I regularly teach a case in criminal law in which a person refused a blood transfusion because of her religious beliefs. The hospital wanted to give her the blood transfusion, and she refused it, even knowing it could result in her death. So people do make those kinds of decisions all the time. Justice Alito, for the majority, told us that it's so unlikely that those kinds of things are going to come up. There's never been a case like that, and we haven't heard of any cases like
that.
But
what if there is?
Well, what if there is? The law always faces backward to an extent. We're looking at what happened, not what is likely to happen. And because of that, I think we're going to see a lot of litigation in general about religious objections to various government mandates.
We're talking with Pitt Law Professor David Harris about recent Supreme Court decisions. You can join the conversation. 412-246-2002 is the number to call. 412-246-2002. If you have a question, anything about these decisions that concerns you or that you're confused about, David can clear that up for you. You can also email us at esspgh@wesa.fm, on Twitter at esspgh, hashtag EPLive. And again, our number, 412-246-2002. And David, before we move on to some other things, just again with regard to the Supreme Court's decision in the Hobby Lobby ruling, where they can object on religious grounds to the Affordable Care Act's contraception mandate. If an employee, if a woman employed by a corporation like Hobby Lobby seeks to purchase birth control pills, a lot of women use these to regulate hormones and for reasons other than birth control per se. What would the situation be with regard to that? Could there be special considerations, or is it just a blanket decision that allows corporations not to consider a woman's particular needs?
It is a blanket decision in that sense, Paul. They don't have to consider that birth control of these particular types could be used for other medical purposes. And that is actually quite common. And it's one of the reasons that advocates for women were quite upset with this decision. They say that it puts medical decision-making in the hands of the employer instead of between individual women and their doctors. I find it hard to disagree with that when it is so common for women to use these kinds of medicines for other purposes. They should have full access to them for what purpose should be up to them and their medical professionals.
Will we see a dramatic shift in how the government can limit religiously prompted conduct in a business setting?
Oh, I think so. I think so. I think this is going to be just the leading case of that edge. You're going to get all kinds of religious-based objections to business practices, and the only one ruled out by the court is race discrimination. Everything else will be considered on the table until the time that the court rules it out.
I wanted to move on to the decision regarding buffer zones around abortion.
Yes.
Around abortion clinics. The ruling that would eliminate those is based on what was done in a case involving a clinic in Boston, I believe.
That's right, Massachusetts.
And so explain that decision and how it might impact a similar law that we have here in Pennsylvania, which also establishes a buffer zone around abortion clinics, but not to the extent that they had in Boston.
Yes. This is a very interesting case because the buffer zone concept is not new. Police, law enforcement, public safety officials use buffer zones all the time in free speech sorts of events, you could say. They put up sawhorses so that the demonstrators can't get at each other. They'll say, you can be over here, but it's too dangerous to be over there. That kind of thing has been allowed. What this case was about was a law passed by the state of Massachusetts that said, not just at this clinic, not just in this incident, but generally speaking, at every clinic in the state of Massachusetts, there is a 35-foot buffer zone. Now, one clinic in Boston had had a substantial problem with violence at that clinic. It was no joke. And so some measures were called for. What the Supreme Court said was, fine, but you have to use a narrowly tailored solution when you're basically prohibiting free speech. Speech on the street, be it offensive or soft, is the prototypical thing that the First Amendment is supposed to protect. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if you want to make regulations of it, and you're allowed to regulate the time, place, and manner of speech, not its content, but the time, place, and manner, you have to be specific and limited and narrow. And passing a law in a whole state that puts the same buffer at every similar situation, every clinic, was just far too broad. There was no evidence that the state had considered other alternatives. So this doesn't mean that every buffer zone is dead everywhere. If a court, for instance, set up a buffer zone around a particular clinic, given particular circumstances of danger or altercations that had already occurred, that may very well stand up. If a whole state does it everywhere, almost certainly the law would go down.
And do we have any idea, have you heard any chatter about what will happen in Pennsylvania now?
I know that the buffer zone, say, in Pittsburgh, around the clinic on Liberty Avenue.
It's considerably less than the one in question in Boston.
Yes, but it isn't the size. It's the way that the buffer zone is set up. And I think that one is through a Pittsburgh ordinance, not a state law. So that will be challenged. There's no doubt. I've heard the person on the radio saying we're going to challenge it. I would expect challenges all over the country to buffer zones, and lower courts will have to sort them out under the Supreme Court's new rule.
And it's interesting because you have a clash of values here,
exactly,
as you've called it, and really what it comes down to is two constitutionally protected rights, which is a constitutionally protected right for women to make a choice, and then also a constitutionally protected right of free speech.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's the thing. We have a wonderful, robust society, largely because we have the ability to speak freely, demonstrate, advocate for our points of view, and it's precious to us. It's in the Bill of Rights. There is also the right to this particular kind of medical procedure under certain conditions that has been found by the Supreme Court to be a constitutionally protected right. Now, some people may disagree with that, think it's wrong, but as of right now, it's a constitutional right to have an abortion. And when you have two constitutional rights in conflict, that's the kind of thing that the Supreme Court often has to weigh into and sort them out.
It's Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking with Pitt Law Professor David Harris about recent Supreme Court decisions, a flurry of activity as the session has come to an end. On June 30th, it ended. And we're looking at how these decisions are impacting our lives. They certainly have far-reaching implications for all of us. And as we sort through them, if you have a comment or question, 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002. One of the issues that we've talked about on this program in the past, and you foresaw this issue with regard to cell phones.
Yes.
And police searches. Up until this recent decision now by the Supreme Court, police could arrest someone and take a cell phone. That is not going to be happening any longer. Explain what the Supreme Court decided.
Yeah, this is very significant, Paul. And I say that fully copping to the charge that I'm a Fourth Amendment nerd from way back. but this is really significant. This is the Supreme Court's establishing the idea of digital privacy. In this case, persons get arrested in a couple of individual incidents. The police take their cell phones. Now, when somebody gets arrested, the police have a right to search you and take things out of your pockets because they could be weapons or because you could destroy evidence. This is long established law. The question is, they take the cell phone out of your pocket. Can they then open it up and start scrolling through your contacts, your text? You're looking at all your data, all your pictures and everything else to find maybe evidence of crimes. That's the real question. Can they not only seize it, but can they open it up? And the Supreme Court said in surprisingly ringing language and unanimously, I mean, it was really surprising to me. No, the court said the police cannot do that without a warrant. They need a warrant to look through the data on your phone. They can seize it. They can keep it. They could pull the battery out of it to secure the data in it or disconnect it from the network in some other way. But they cannot look through all the data without having a warrant. The court says this is different than simply taking a package of cigarettes out of somebody's a pocket and looking in there for joints or capsules of heroin, something like that.
Well, it's really the same as going into a person's house, and this is what our founding fathers would have envisioned. Not the cell phones, but you know, the idea of somebody kicking down your door and going through all your papers.
Absolutely.
And it's sort of, I guess it's a surprise that it took this long, isn't it, that for someone to equate the cell phone, it's storing data. It's coming down to whether it's written down on a piece of paper, as it was in the old days, or it's in your phone.
It's true.
It's the modern way of keeping your notes and your diary.
Yes, and the court made that exact analogy to a diary. There'd probably be no other place in the colonial American world in which so much personal information would be amassed other than a diary. Now, people would be very unlikely to take a diary outside and just walk around with it. They'd keep it in a locked drawer somewhere, and it would be in your house. And part of what stimulated the American Revolution was the British practice of going into homes with what were called writs of assistance. These were very general warrants that said basically go into Harris's house and just look around, see what you can find. Do anything you want. And that was a major, major issue to the founding fathers in the colonial times. Now, today, the Supreme Court says the cell phone contains even more information than you'd be likely to get in somebody's house. And the fact that it's all in one place, that it's shown in sequence, that it's photos and calendars and GPS coordinates and this, that, and the other thing, this can paint a whole picture of a person's life in detail and in ways that are just unimaginable before now. It was really easy for me to envision reading this opinion that the justices had their own cell phones and they could easily imagine, you know, what if I got stopped for a traffic ticket? You mean somebody could just look through all that stuff, my prescriptions, my calls with my wife, my this, my that? That, I think, is responsible for the giant leap here. And I call it a leap because other technology cases, they haven't done so well. They haven't gone as far as they needed to. They haven't really understood the technology. Here, clearly, they did, and they have created new protections for digital privacy.
And if the cops want to get at somebody's information, we're talking about a really bad guy, they can still get it. They just have to have a warrant.
Absolutely.
The question then becomes, though, from the standpoint – we've been looking at this from the standpoint of the individual.
Yes.
and our own rights to personal privacy. But from a law enforcement standpoint, this may cause some frustrations. Is there a concern now that a criminal – could erase all of the information in their phone, and then by the time they have to turn it over, well, here you go, and everything that the law enforcement officials were looking for is gone.
No real concern about erasing. The justices actually confronted that. The government made that argument, and the court said correctly, I think, all you have to do is seize the phone, keep it out of the defendant's hands, and take out the battery. There's no danger after that of remote wiping or anything like that where you would the data would just disappear. Number two, if it is a true emergency, something like a kidnapping where life is in the balance, a terrorist attack, something like that, the exigent circumstances exception, the emergency circumstances exception will take care of it. They'd have to go to a court later and justify the fact of the existence of an emergency, but they don't have to get a warrant in a true emergency. But number three, it's a mistake to think that a warrant requirement will get in the way. You can get a warrant telephonically in a lot of jurisdictions. You can use the mobile data terminals in police cars. It isn't that hard. There is a delay, but as Justice Roberts said for the majority, privacy has a cost. And if we want to have privacy, we have to pay that cost, even if sometimes it will give the advantage to the bad guy.
Talking with Pitt Law Professor David Harris, we'll try to hit a few more issues before we wrap this up in the next few minutes. Affirmative action can now be banned by state constitutional amendment. The court has allowed states to do this. Explain how and why.
Yeah, it's almost 10 years ago since the court reviewed the college admission policies in Michigan and found that race could be, in certain limited circumstances, considered as a factor in college admissions. What that decision did was it stimulated action on the ground in Michigan. A referendum went on the ballot that basically banned affirmative action in all college admissions. And it went, that referendum passed it as a state constitutional amendment. And what the court said in this case was, if the voters speak, that's that. There is no sense in which we would limit the voters' ability to put that on their state constitutional, put that in their state constitution. And the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution does not prohibit it. There used to be a theory that you couldn't prohibit people from advocating for minority political positions when that, those positions had to do with race. But the court threw that theory out and said, if you're putting it on the state ballot and it passes, that's the final word. Not that affirmative action is bad or anything changes about affirmative action. The court was careful to say that debate is not resolved today. It's just that if the people of a state speak and put it in their constitution, that holds.
Sectarian prayer to begin legislative sessions, another issue. Explain what decision the court made here. They are allowing this.
Yeah, in the past, the court has approved the giving of a prayer at the beginning of a legislative session. This is an old historical practice back into the first Congresses and the Constitutional Convention and so forth. But past cases have always dealt with very non-sectarian invocations of the Supreme Being, asking for God's blessings. In this case, you had a small town setting of the town of Greece in upstate New York. In that setting, you had sectarian prayers, most of them invoking Jesus Christ in some way, most of them Christian. And the court said, no, this is okay too, as long as everybody has a chance, all religions have a chance to give the prayer.
And finally, campaign contributions. The court strikes down aggregate limits on campaign contributions.
That's right. This is of a piece with Citizens United from just a couple of years ago, which, as you may remember, struck down all kinds of campaign mm-hmm. contribution limits and secrecy and so forth. There was an aggregate limit on the number of campaign contributions in the federal system that a person could give. It was something like $48,000 in chunks of about $2,500. So that limited your contributions to something like 20 candidates if everybody got the max. And what the Supreme Court says is there's no challenge here to the maximum per candidate. But we're going to wipe out the aggregate limits of $48,000. So now you can make as many contributions of $2,400, $2,500 to as many candidates as you want, to political parties. I think the best description of this was a blog post I read that called this and the prior case together Oligarchs United. You're going to have lots of money flowing into the process. This is just another step in the Supreme Court's dismantling of campaign finance laws that have existed since the 70s.
Pitt Law Professor David Harris joining us to talk about the recent Supreme Court decisions. The Supreme Court completing its term on Monday with a flurry of decisions. And David, you've helped us to, I think, make some sense out of them. Thank you so much for being with us, and happy Independence Day to you, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Paul. You the same, and I'm glad to be with you.
Coming up, will we see $4 a gallon gas on the 4th of July? It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.